How would you feel if you knew your life would have a happy ending? That's the way Rico Tice started a recent Hope Explored course, and he was shocked by the answers he got back. Bored, someone said. Life would be boring. So, this morning, step into the shoes of Pastor Wang Yi. He's the pastor of one of China's largest house churches, the Early Rain Covenant Church in Chengdu. Actually, you probably don't want to step into his shoes because the church has been closed. Pastor Wang has been arrested, jailed for his faith, and according to one report I read, he has in effect disappeared. But as you suffer in whatever prison he's locked up in, to know that President Xi would not have the final word on you, to know you're actually on the winning side, to know the Jesus you're suffering for now will be the ultimate conqueror, that his rescue could be relied on, I suspect to know that ending would not be boring. It just might make a painful life worth living. Jeremy Hunt, the British Foreign Minister, ordered research on those persecuted for their faith recently, and it found that Christians were the most persecuted religious group in the world. And in parts of the world, that persecution neared genocide levels. It's nothing new. This book of Revelation was written to persecuted Christians by a persecuted Christian. John, the author, is a prisoner for his faith on the Roman penal colony island of Patmos, cut off from the world under the thumb of the military guards. But this is Pentecost Sunday, and no better reminder of God's ability to break into a closed universe, of the Spirit's ability to speak into a closed world and closed minds. And as John introduces his book, he explains, on the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit. That Spirit gives John a whole series of pictures, visions, revelations to tell him what he could never work out for himself. Time and again, John climbs into the control room, is taken to heaven's throne room, and is shown where history's going, how it'll end, how his story never ends. And how when our story becomes part of his story, his future becomes ours too. Boring? It certainly isn't. Rather an exciting, terrifying, encouraging, vital journey to travel, and chapter 5 is part of that journey. Well, you say, if that's true, what's it all got to do with the gift day and this building? Well, let me say this. Why this building matters is not at the end of the day because of its architecture. Though it's wonderful to have an iconic, recognizable building. It's not at the end of the day even because of its location, though, as Paul explained, it's a brilliant location for a church, so accessible, easy to find, right at the heart of the West End. It's not even because of its size. Where else are you going to find a place where you can fit hundreds and hundreds of people in like this? This building actually matters because of who's in it. Here's where you'll find people who have that forever future. This building matters because of what you'll discover here. The message that makes sense of life, the Jesus who makes sense of life. Divorce the building from the message, divorce the building from this Jesus, and its value plummets. And it's worth investing in it because of what this building could do for the gospel, for Jesus. Here are a couple of things this building should be. It should be, firstly, a place where the crying stops. That's this opening paragraph of chapter 5. You see, as we read Revelation, with all of its strange-to-us symbolism, don't reduce the Spirit to some crossword clue setter. you know, trying to stretch our brains with the next cryptic clue. John engages with his vision with far more than the analytical mind of someone wrestling with a riddle. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. The scroll turns out in the coming chapters to be the scroll of history, but it's securely sealed. So, verse 2, I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" Who can give us understanding? Who can make sense of life? Who can give control to history? But verse 3, no one in heaven, on earth, or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. See, the tragedy is that no one can. There's a whole history to be lived and no one to control it or explain it. The search committee draws up a list of the most powerful figures from anywhere and draws a blank. Now, last week at the D-Day celebrations in Portsmouth, there was an impressive, powerful lineup. I don't know if you saw the pictures, but it went from Chancellor Merkel, President Trump, Her Majesty the Queen, Prime Minister May, President Macron. All that power, but none fit for this. The frustration and despair is all too much for John. Look at verse 4. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. The frustrations, the meaninglessness that makes of life reduces John to tears. See, when you can't get a handle on life or a control on history and you don't know anyone who can, it means tears are often all that's left. I mean, you get glimpses of it, don't you, from time to time. We saw it on a bit of a macro scale the other week with Theresa May's resignation speech. All the meaningless frustration of not being able to give meaning or control to her Brexit plan, which has reduced her premiership to little or nothing. We saw it on the more personal micro scale last week with the tragic story of Noah Pothoven, the Dutch girl for whom life robbed her of meaning, sexually molested at 11, raped at 14, allowed to starve herself to death at 17. Her teenage diary became an autobiography. Her depression and mental pain became unbearable. She wrote this at one point, "I breathe, but no longer live." Now, before your mind races into the rights and wrongs of what was allowed to happen, don't go there until you've cried first. The tragedy of that. Whatever the scale, you see, life's uncertainties and pointlessness can cause the tears to flow. I wept and wept, says John. But actually, this vision's here to put an end to those desperate, despairing tears. Look at verse 5. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Now, it's not some magic wand, end of all problems solution, as if frustrations and sufferings are swept aside. It doesn't reduce us to some glib, superficial, clap-happy church. When the scroll is opened in the next chapter, it reveals a bleak history of judgments on a broken, fallen world. But John has been told it's not random. It's not meaningless. This Lion of Judah, this Root of David, Jesus, is the King who controls, who means we don't need to fear history, whose story must triumph in the end, and Chancellor and President and Prime Minister and King and Queen will all bow the knee. It doesn't answer all my why questions. Why this? Why that? Why the other? But it tells me who. Who can make sense of life? Who can give purpose to the mess of life? As the Apostle Paul put it, all things were created through Christ and for him. Miss that, and you're going to miss the point. As John was experiencing it, his life reduced to the shrinking circle of the penal colony, facing the obscurity of an anonymous death. You know, when no one will know it happened or why it happened or what he stood for. Becoming the kind of nobody who is just, well, there's a great line Boris Pasternak wrote in Dr. Zhivago about nameless numbers on a file long since mislaid. That life discovers his Lord is the Lord, who will triumph and give meaning and purpose even to the most insignificant of lives. To find a place where I can discover a gospel like that, a Jesus who's not just my maker and judge, but my rescuer too, in all of life's uncertainties, to find where the crying stops. That's priceless. That's priceless. Here's another reason why the building's important. It's a place where the crying stops. It's also a place where we sing the song that never ends. Now, I'm not meaning like one of those songs where you repeat the chorus again and again and again and again and again, but a song that always holds true forever. You know how sometimes we say to people, I can't thank you enough for. They've done something remarkable for us. Well, this is the one we really can't thank enough. Look at verse 6. Then I saw a lamb, which is actually a big shock because John was expecting to see a lion. Now, don't get too frightened by these symbols. We use them ourselves, actually. We're used to nations using animals as symbols for them. Only normally they're chosen as signs of strength, aren't they? The Russian bear, the British lion, the American eagle. Leon Morris, the commentator, writes, it's only the kingdom of heaven that would dare to use as its symbol of might, not the lion for which John was looking, but the helpless lamb. And at that, a slain lamb. Because you see how verse 6 goes on. Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain. The lamb, of course, is Jesus, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, as John the Baptist describes him. Jesus, who was slain, executed, crucified, bears the marks, but is now the risen, ascended Christ. And he's standing, you notice, at the center of the throne. As if the slain lamb, the cross of Jesus, is somehow at the center of his story, the pivot of history, the focus of eternity. And he's encircled there by the four living creatures and the elders. And the lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, or probably better, the sevenfold spirit of God, sent out into all the earth. Now, seven's a number of perfection and completeness. This once crucified lamb actually has complete strength for the task. The horns is all-seeing, brings the fullness of God's Spirit to his mission. So verse 7, he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he'd taken it, the four living creatures, the 24 elders, fell down before the Lamb. He's the center of their worship. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. Stop for a moment and think, isn't that an encouragement? All those prayers I prayed that seemed so futile at the time, so feeble. What became of them? Well, here they are, in the throne room of heaven. See, remember that next time I pray, or rather, next time I'm tempted not to pray. And verse 9, they sang a new song. Now, here is the song of heaven we get to learn in advance. We've remembered this past week those who gave their lives on D-Day for our freedom, but we remember for eternity the one who paid the greatest sacrifice. They sang a new song saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals." Why? Well, look, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God. Yeah, it's a song about Jesus, the Jesus who gave his life for us, the Jesus who can transform our story, catch it up in his, whatever our starting point. I mean, catch on to the wonder of it all. You're from a country with no gospel history, little or no Christian awareness. Okay, this is still the Jesus for you. Look at verse 9. "With your blood, Jesus, you purchased for God a people from every tribe and language and people and nation." You can't come from the wrong one. It was the promise made to Abraham way back in Genesis, and John hears it now, and in a couple of chapters' time, he'll actually see it in another vision. This is a God who delivers on his promises, whose kingdom reach stretches everywhere. Now, let me put it this way. If John was here this morning, the John who was on the island of Patmos, he'd be amazed to look around and see the snapshot of this promise that we enjoy every Sunday at All Souls. Today, nearly a third of the world's population is Christian. But in his day, Christians were such a tiny, tiny minority. It would be astonishing to imagine they would triumph. Every tribe and language and people and nation. Or imagine the worthless, messed up life full of guilty secrets or not so secret guilts, discovering a Christ who, verse 10, made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God. The one written off as a criminal, finding a Jesus who says they will reign on earth. And that's who you find here in All Souls, the unlikeliest people who will one day reign in God's new creation on the earth. So treat the person you're sitting next to carefully. You're probably sitting next to someone eternally important. I know they don't look it, but it doesn't mean they aren't it. No wonder the praise is overwhelming. Verse 11, "Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. And in a loud voice they were saying, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise.'" That is the song that will never end, that will never stop being sung. So, as we draw to a close, let me just come back to that earlier question. Why is this All Souls building important? Why is it worth investing in this gift day? Because it is a place where the crying stops, where I can find the one who can make sense of life. See, just next door, there's the BBC, and they're reporting the news, aren't they? And they're assessing the news and explaining the news and analysing the news and speculating on the news. But here's actually the place to find where history is really heading. To find the Jesus who can bring purpose to the mess. Here's the place where we sing the song that never ends. There are so many songs from so many playlists ringing in our ears day after day, competing for our hearts. It matters that we have places to learn this song, to be reminded of it when it gets squeezed out of our heads. "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain." It's the song about Jesus, and typical of the Spirit of God, because he's always pointing us to Jesus. It's the song of heaven And we've got it ahead of time to sustain us now. We get to learn the tune early, so to speak. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. And we learn the song because we've seen the future. See, it's why giving is not wasting money. It's investing in the kingdom. In Paris the other month, when Notre Dame burnt out, they pledged millions to restore it. And they're looking back, wanting to preserve their heritage. Here, where the All Souls building is wearing out, we're spending to restore it too. But we're investing looking forwards. See, you learn the song here, but it's not confined to the building. Now take it with you as you go. Hum it to yourself, whistle it to others, sing the song, whether it's at home, on the campus, in the office, on the ward. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain, every tribe and language and people and nation. Yeah, next door, the home of the BBC World Service. A service they're rightly proud of. But very few of the thousands who work there day by day realize this building, their neighbor, is the home of another World Service. And there'll come a day when only one of those will still be on the air. And the song it'll be singing will be, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain." While this building is still teaching that song, invest in the building to reach the world. Amen.